The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
She tried for about 7 years to place me with various houses and with various projects, and it just never happened. And finally she said, you know, I really think you need to stop writing for a year. And which I thought was just a devastating thing to say. And she said, you know, all I want you to do for a year is just read, because you don't know who you are as a writer yet. And to figure out who you are as a writer, you have to know who you are as a reader. And honestly, I thought it was just like a complete brush off. I thought it was her, you know, just kind of very polite upstate New York way of saying, I don't want to work with you anymore. Right off into the sunset. Bye. But I took her advice. You know, I was so disheartened at that point that I said, yeah, maybe a year off is the best thing to do. So I just went off and I read for a year. And I had asked her, I said, well, what am I supposed to do at the end of the year? And she said, you'll know, which I thought was actually kind of a smart ass response. But I looked around at the end of that year and I did know. I knew exactly what to do.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. This is your dutiful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Award-winning and New York Times bestselling author Deanna Rayburn spoke to me about how she still feels like a debut author, why she doesn't read reviews, and her new contemporary thriller, Killers of a Certain Age. Deanna is the author of 19 books, including the award-winning New York Times bestselling Lady Julia Gray series, as well as the USA Today bestselling and Edgar-nominated Veronica Speedwell Mysteries, and several standalone works. Her latest is Killers of a Certain Age, described as a witty contemporary spy thriller perfect for fans of Killing Eve and Ocean's 8. An instant New York Times bestseller and an Amazon Best Book of the Month 2022, BuzzFeed said of the book, this Golden Girls meets James Bond thriller is a journey you want to be a part of. Deanna graduated with a double major in English and History from the University of Texas at San Antonio. Stay tuned until the end of the show for a preview of the audiobook excerpted courtesy Penguin Random House Audio from Killers of a Certain Age by Deanna Rayburn, read by Jane Oppenheimer and Christina Delane. In this file, Deanna and I discussed why her agent told her to stop writing for a whole year, what it feels like to get that first three-book deal, how she came to writing older women doing kick-ass things, when she turns into a feral author in her pajamas, why writers need to trust their inner voice, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates, get links to merch, and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. Well, welcome back to The Writer Files. I am very honored today to be joined by award-winning New York Times bestselling author, Deanna Rayburn. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. On the birth of your latest, this is the launch pub date.
It is. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. What's the vibe over there?
The vibe is crazy right now. I am actually in a hotel room in St. Louis doing about 12 interviews back to back, and trying to keep my voice together and my answers coherent. And so hopefully I will be worth your time as a guest.
Yeah, well, you know, we could try something different. You could just type your answers into the chat and I could just read them out loud. Would that be? Just kidding. Yes, of course, we want to hear your lovely voice. And we can't wait to dig into all things writing and your latest, this fantastic standalone novel, Killers of a Certain Age, which I can't wait to talk about. But yeah, so aside from the craziness, let's talk about your superhero origins a little bit, because you have had this prolific career with quite a few successes and just lots going on. But I want to talk about all the things and kind of wind the clock back a little bit to, kind of how you have ascended to bestselling author and take us back, if you will. I know, I understand that you studied, that you had a double major in English and history in college, but yeah, talk about kind of like how your life became one of a prolific series writer.
Yeah, right now I'm having kind of an out-of-body experience because you talk about these things and it sounds like I have this great successful career and I'm like, who, me? because somewhere in my head, I'm still like a debut author, which is ridiculous because I've written 19 books. So at some point you think I would get past that, right? I double majored in college in English and history because I always knew I wanted to write and I always knew I wanted to write historical fiction. And then I also got my teaching certificate because I wanted to eat while I was figuring out how to get published. And I was a terrible teacher. I lasted about 3 years before I noped on out of that job. I wrote my first novel when I was 23 and sent it in over the transom, and it has never been published. It lives in a box in my attic and it's terrible. But the editor I sent it to said, yeah, I'm not publishing this. It's 120,000 words. And I published 80,000 word novels. Nice try, kid. But he also said, I think your writing is absolutely wonderful. And that kind of gave me the confidence a few years later when I had a better novel to go find an agent. And she tried for about 7 years to place me with various houses and with various projects. And it just never happened. And finally she said, you know, I really think you need to stop writing for a year. And which I thought was just a devastating thing to say. And she said, you know, all I want you to do for a year is just read. Because you don't know who you are as a writer yet. And to figure out who you are as a writer, you have to know who you are as a reader. And honestly, I thought it was just like a complete brush off. I thought it was her really, really suitor, you know, just kind of very polite upstate New York way of saying, I don't want to work with you anymore. Right off into the sunset. Bye. But I took her advice. You know, I was so disheartened at that point that I said, yeah, maybe a year off is the best thing to do. So I just went off and I read for a year. And at the end of that year, and I had asked her, I said, well, what am I supposed to do at the end of the year? And she said, you'll know, which I thought was actually kind of a smart ass response. But I looked around at the end of that year and I did know. I knew exactly what to do because I looked at the books and they all had things in common. They were all structured as mysteries. They all had a historical setting. They all had a strong female central character. They all had a British sensibility and kind of a dry sense of humor to them. And I went, holy crap, that's a blueprint. That's a blueprint for the book that I need to write. And so I sat down and wrote that book, which took me 2 years, and I sent it into her. So by now it's 3 years since I've talked to my agent. I sent it into her, and a week later she'd read it and she called me and said, this is it. This is the one. And it was, it took her 2 years to sell it. But when she did, we got a 3-book deal. And then just a couple of months later, they came back for another 3-book deal. So I went from being a person who couldn't like get run over by a golf cart in the streets of publishing to a person with a 6-book, you know, 6 books under contract, which was a bizarre, bizarre thing. And I've been under contract and writing ever since. I've switched publishing houses, but I've got 2 successful historical mystery series under my belt. And now I have shifted gears just a little bit to do my first contemporary.
When I look at your catalog, it's pretty incredible to see how many novels you've written since then, and novellas as well. And yeah, a very cool story and an inspiring one. But I think ultimately I want to talk about, of course, Killers of a Certain Age, and the reception has been like just amazing. Don't you think? I mean, how are you feeling about
it? It's bonkers. Yeah. It's absolutely bonkers. I mean, I knew that the buzz was different about this one because you get a feel in the publishing house. Like you can tell when my publisher is super enthusiastic and amazingly supportive and lovely with my historical series. This was just kind of a whole bridge beyond that. And yeah. I knew things were building. And then all of a sudden we get word that it's going to be a Book of the Month selection. And then we started getting the trade reviews in, and I think we're up to 4 of those that have been starred. And so it's just like, what?
Congratulations. It's really cool. It's a beautiful cover too, I think.
Oh my God. The Berkeley Art Department does the most stupendous covers. They do gorgeous, gorgeous work on my historical series. And I thought, yeah, you're not going to top that. And then they come out with this gorgeous graphic, very simple, very noir, straightforward. Yeah. Very noir, but there's a pearl bracelet. So yeah.
That's amazing. Well, colors of a certain age, and I'll talk a little bit about or the description here, is a contemporary feminist tale brimming with acerbic wit, featuring modern heroines who prove that age can be an asset in a world that often values youth over wisdom. But yeah, some of these blurbs are incredible. Congrats on the Amazon Best Book of the Month, 2022. Had just mentioned, I'll quote, novels about trained assassins rarely address the retirement package. this sentence got me. It's very funny. Granny, get your gun, because this novel, sharp as battery acid, fast as a bullet, and hilarious to boot, pits men against women, age against youth, technology against old school know-how, and on top of that, illustrates an excellent use for a piano wire necklace.
Oh, geez, that's great. See, I don't read reviews, so I had,
okay.
No, they will have review parties in an email when they come in, like, you know, when these starred reviews have come in, and everybody at the publishing company emails my agent and my husband, and they will all like hang out, and isn't this great? And all they do is tell me, oh, hey, Publishers Weekly came in, it's a star, or Kirkus came in, it's a star. That's all I know. I never read them. And so they have these great celebrations without me. But that's really cool. I like that line. Yeah, that's awesome.
That's a good one. And your peers have had so many great things to say about it. But yeah, congrats on the work. And it's got to feel good to have a book that's a standalone. And as the description mentions, a contemporary. But yeah, talk a little bit about the feminist piece, because you know, ultimately, I think as I'm reading about, you know, just the descriptions and the content, you know, ageism in publishing has probably been something that's, you know, been around since the dawn of publishing. But let's talk a little bit about why maybe now that it's more prevalent than ever, you know, isn't there this bright and shiny kind of literary phenomenon, literary phenom kind of thing happening?
You know, I'm very, very gratified by the fact that this book came about because my publisher came to me and said, we just want a book. We think there need to be more books about older women doing kick-ass things. And we think you are the absolute perfect person to write one. And I took that as a huge compliment. And they said, would you be interested? That's literally the entire brief. Older women, something kick-ass. We don't care about any of the rest of it. You are free to do whatever you like. And I went off and I had to think about it. And I decided, yeah, this is a really cool opportunity. So I came back and I told him, I said, I want them to be 60, which is significantly older than I've ever written before. I think my oldest heroine has been in her maybe early 30s. So this was definitely, you know, a departure for me. And I told them I wanted them to be assassins, and they were like, cool, cool. And then I said, and I want it to be contemporary. And they were like, record scratch. It was like, what? I think they were mildly terrified of me writing a contemporary, because I was hugely terrified of me writing a contemporary. It's a cat of a different color, man. Mm-hmm. If you're not used to writing in that voice, then that can just be, I mean, it can be annihilating trying to find that very, very different author voice. And there are people who specialize in one thing and who do it well. And I had found my historical voice. And so my terror was, what if I don't have a contemporary voice? And it took me a little while to get there. And it did not click for me until I was playing around one day with a scene, and I gave it to my husband. I said, hey, read this. Tell me what you think. And he said, it sounds like your Twitter voice. He said, this sounds like you tweeting. And I went, nailed it. This is what I'm doing now, because I figured out that was what, you know, because I love Twitter. I have a lot of fun on Twitter, but I thought that's what it needed, was that kind of, you know, a little bit tongue in cheek, not taking itself too seriously, vibe is what it needed, because there are serious issues going on. You know, it's not always enjoyable to be getting older. It's not always enjoyable to be overlooked or to be undervalued because of your gender or because of you know, the hierarchy of where you work, or, you know, to lose out on opportunities or to be forced into situations like retiring and giving up a job that you love just because of the fact that, you know, you hit a benchmark birthday. You know, and of course, murder is serious. So, you know, it was, I thought, a good idea to kind of leaven all of that, because I could not imagine spending months and months and months mired in a book that was going to be dark or was going to be dense or too heavy or grim, because that's not who I am as a person. That's not what I like to read. That's not how I live. So I wanted, my idea was, if I couldn't make it a fun kind of capery type of thriller, then I didn't want to do it. It still shocks me though, when, like, somebody last week referred to me as a contemporary thriller writer, and I just, what? Me? I'm a huge chicken. I don't, what?
Yeah. Well, again, congrats on the reception. And I don't know. I want to talk about the making of the book, of course. And it sounds like you kind of were experimenting with some voices early on. And of course, this book, as you mentioned, is a contemporary thriller and kind of jumps around in time a little bit at the start to set the stage, which I thought actually was very funny. And the acerbic wit comes through, is through and through, and it is very fun. Because obviously you have a sense of humor about this, this kind of caper, as you mentioned, but, you're saying, oh, I thought one line that popped out to me that I thought was very funny was, I put down my protest signs and stamped out my burning bra and let them make a killer out of me. Yes. So anyway, talk a little bit about the making of it. And as you said, once you've established, kind of, you know, all the things and, you know, done whatever research you're going to do and you're rolling, like, describe the best writing day for you. How does that start? How does it feel, smell, that kind of thing? Are you getting up at the crack of dawn? Are you somebody who writes late into the evening? Do you like a coffee shop setting?
I never write in public, and I'm a morning person. So I write in the morning. You know, for me, this book had multiple kind of incarnations, because I would write it and I'd write a draft and send it in, and my editor would come back with notes, and they were, you know, she pushed me and I wanted her to. I wanted the book to be the best that I could make it. And so I said, yeah, I'm do what you have to do. And she did. And she would come back and I would get the notes and I would go have a good cry. And then I would get back to work. And, you know, we had to do that around the Veronica Speedwell books, which is the historical series that I still have running. So I had those on contract and do. So I would fit in different drafts of this book, and it was evolving every time. The thing that kept me going is every draft I knew I was getting closer. I knew it was getting better. And so did my editor. You know, she said, big picture, we're getting there. And I know it's taking a while, but I can see it. I know it's happening. And I was like, okay, if you say so. But then finally, it literally did not click for me until 96 hours before the book was due. And I'm talking about the drop dead deadline. Like, we're going into production. You have to be finished with it. I suddenly, and I don't know why, it was that moment where it all finally fell into place. And I realized what the structure needed to be, because we have a contemporary narrative of what these four 60-year-olds are up to. But then we have these other scenes that are flashback scenes to their recruitment, to their earlier missions. And finally, like, I saw it just blinding clarity exactly where they needed to be positioned. And so I had to tear the book apart in order to put them in the right places. And I literally had that amount of time to do it in. So for 96 hours, I stayed in my pajamas and I wrote and I fell into bed and I woke up and I ate something and I wrote some more. And I was absolutely feral by the time this book was in it. I was disgusting, but it got done. And when I finished it, I was like, okay, I have done my absolute best. There is blood on the page at this point, which I don't advocate. Like, this is not a healthy way to work. Like, we need balance as writers. But my editor called me, and it's always a weird thing when your editor calls at like 6 o'clock on a Friday night. Because you know that, like, you see the name on the caller across your phone on the caller ID, and you're like, oh no,
oh shit,
oh this is exactly. And I answered the phone, and she said, I hope you are so proud of this book. And she said, because you did it, this is it. And and then I burst into tears again, but for a completely different reason. And it, yeah, that was when I knew I had finally cracked it. But no, I like to work in the morning. And I only ever write for about an hour, hour and a half. But I only write on the computer because I'm old, and I learned how to type back when it was called typing. it wasn't keyboarding. There were no, it was an IBM Selectric, and my teacher was the golf coach, and it was great. And I can type over 100 words a minute, and so it you know, just touch typing, and it means I can write really fast. So I sit down, and for me, it's always very cinematic. I'm watching it happen. And I know exactly what's going to happen. And I sit down and I write, usually I write a scene, but if I'm having a really, you know, kind of a slog through the middle, sometimes I will just write to a page quota.
Mm.
And then I stop because I know exactly then what I'll be doing the next day, because I'm only halfway through a scene.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it a little bit easier then to get into the vibe of what I've got to pick up for the next day.
Yeah, interesting. So you're still on the IBM Selectric, I take it.
No.
Okay.
No. I wish though. Wouldn't that be cool? That'd be amazing. No, I finally upgraded this year and I have gone with all things Apple finally.
Okay.
So I'm still learning my way around all of that. But yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Good. Coffee, tea?
Tea, always.
Tea, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. My grandmother was English, so.
Ah, I see. Okay. So.
It's a cultural thing.
It's a cultural thing.
It is.
Well, of course, I will point at all the things. Your home base there is deannarayburn.com. And there's a link there to Twitter and Instagram. The Twitter is a lot of fun to follow. Listeners, check that out. The book, of course, Killers of a Certain Age. I thought your peers said some very nice things, but I wanted to punch up. Jocelyn Jackson said, National treasure, Deanna Rayburn. Never fails to enchant with her signature dry wit, sophisticated storylines, slick twists, and smart, eccentric women who anchor her books. That was very nice of her to say. She called you a national treasure.
Yeah, that's been a running joke between us for about 7 or 8 years now. Okay. We met at a book festival in Dahlonega, Georgia, and we just immediately clicked. I'm a huge fan of her work, and she's a fan of mine. And it's really nice when you make those author friendships, and yeah. You're like, oh my God, I like you as much as I like your books. And she just looked at me one day and she said, you're just a goddamn national treasure. And I said, no, you are. And so it just became a running joke that we think of each other as national treasures. And I was going to put it in a book of hers that I blurbed one time. And I was like, no, I can't possibly. And then she went and did it.
Uh-huh.
And then she went and did it on mine. And I was like, damn you, Jocelyn.
She got
but
you.
She's amazing. Yeah, she's a phenomenal writer. So she's one of those people who, the fact that she likes my stuff, I get a little bashful about, because I'm like, oh, Jocelyn Jackson likes my stuff. and she is the sort of person, she would never in 1,000 years blurb a book she doesn't like. She didn't do it just because we're friends and I know where she lives. There's no way.
Okay, that's good to know. I thought this Library Journal star review said something that I was thinking too, but I'll just read this one real quick. Fans of Rayburn's Veronica Speedwell historical mysteries will enjoy this well-plotted story, and a thriller featuring four skilled, well-trained women is a treat in a male-dominated genre. A fast-paced, explosive, fun novel reminiscent of the 2010 movie Red. And immediately when I had started reading the book and read some of the reviews, I was thinking myself of Helen Mirren in that fantastic role, you know, as the retired assassin. But yeah, you obviously have exploded this milieu. But yeah, talk about what's next, because this seems like it could be a series. Obviously, you'll have to elaborate on that, and we don't want to give any spoilers, but is Hollywood sniffing around?
You know, I've been instructed that all I can say is discussions are happening and people are talking. There has definitely been talk, and there are ongoing discussions. And the one thing I can say is right off the bat, as soon as the arcs were available, I got an email on a Saturday night at like 7 o'clock from a producer who put out a movie that I absolutely loved. And he was like, "This book is brilliant." And I was like, "Oh my God." And he was like, "Oh, I'm so-and-so and I produce." And I was thinking to myself, "I know who you are too." there has absolutely been some interest, and we're having some lovely discussions, and I hope eventually things work out and this does come to pass. You know, getting something adapted is always just, it's such a crapshoot, and it can go awry at any stage of the development. But this is something I would absolutely love to see happen, because I feel like it would lend itself to it really well. And honestly, I would just love to see 4 60-year-old women kicking ass on screen. I mean, I think that would be so much fun.
Yeah. And I think with some of the interstitial stuff that you mentioned, kind of these flashbacks, I almost kind of had imagined like a Quentin Tarantino vibe.
Well, I mean, I would love to see everything kind of under the direction of a female production company with a female director, you know. And I think too, there's huge scope there, because you've got the 4 60-year-old women, but then you've got them as 20-year-olds, and then you've got a couple of other characters who are involved as well. I think altogether we've probably got like 12 or 13 roles for women. And I'm trying to think of the last time a film came out with quite that many roles for women, where they're doing something that would be, you know, this much fun, where they get to go out and, you know, they don't have to stand around and wait for some dude to show up in a superhero cape.
We'll be looking for that news on that. We'll follow the Twitter. I'm sure that when some things actually concretize that you will be sharing, I hope.
I will shout it from the rooftops.
So you've got other running series and IP. Talk about like what you're working on presently, and then what's next for you.
Well, I am currently working on, I just put book 8 in the Veronica Speedwell series to bed, and I'm getting ready to start writing Veronica 9, and I have a couple of other projects in discussion with my publisher. So lots of fun stuff coming down the pike, and you know, they're not going to let me rest, and I don't want to. So everybody's happy.
Very cool. All right. One quick fun one for you. If you could have dinner with any author from any era, to your favorite place in the world, and yes, you can bring Joshua in, who would you take? Where would you take them?
I would probably, you know, on the one hand, I'm thinking Jane Austen, because Girlfriend needed to get out a little bit. But I gotta say probably Aphra Behn, because she was a playwright who was also a spy in the Restoration Court of Charles II. And I feel like I would like to take her out for margaritas. Because I feel like she would have just the most amazing stories.
Very cool. All right. I'll buy the guacamole and the chips.
Excellent. You're invited. Also.
Okay, cool. well, thank you so much for your time, your wisdom. If you had like just one pearl of wisdom to drop on your fellow scribes on just how to persevere. I mean, you've had this incredibly prolific career, but of course you've experienced some adversity yourself. What would you just drop?
Really to trust yourself, because, you know, kind of to paraphrase Dr. Spock, you know more than you think you do. And if you look too much to other people for advice, all they know, like all I can tell you about being a writer is how I do it and what works for me. And that doesn't mean that if you do it differently, that what you're doing is wrong. You know, it's such an idiosyncratic art, and everybody has to be an artist in their own way. So if I ever drop a piece of advice and somebody finds it's useful, great. If it's not useful, man, throw it out.
Love it. Thank you again. Best of luck with everything. And we hope you come back in the future and rap with us again. I know you got to get going. So we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Your attention, please. The museum will be closing in 10 minutes. Any security officer can direct you to an exit. We hope you have enjoyed your visit.
If you expect me to tell you the name of the organization I work for, stop listening right now. It's a secret. So secret, in fact, that those of us who work there never use the official title. We always refer to it as the museum. And we use museum nomenclature to make it a little less obvious to anybody listening in that our job is to eliminate people who need killing. The men and women who established the museum were an international conglomeration of former SOE and OSS agents, French, Polish, and Dutch resistance, and a few of the leftover monuments men who had secured the art collections of Europe while stormtroopers stomped their way around the continent. Basically, everyone who wanted to go hunting Nazis and didn't have a mandate from their government got together and decided to write their own. They were the oddballs and eccentrics, the quirky ones who made brilliant leaps in logic and didn't so much go by the book as fling it out the window. They hunted former members of the Third Reich, everyone from Hitler's shoeshine boy to Treblinka guards. Through Brazilian jungles, Buenos Aires, whorehouses, and villas outside Pretoria, they wrote down every last one they could find. When they'd exhausted their list of Nazis to bring to justice, they had turned to others. Dictators, arms dealers, drug smugglers, and sex traffickers. It was the Wild West with no law but natural justice. And I suppose those were the good old days. Not entirely, of course. The museum, for all its high-minded principles, has been a little slow on social justice. But at least when we joined, there was a hum in the air, the electric fizz of anticipation, of knowing you were doing something worthwhile and doing it better than anybody else. That's how they got me, of course. They found me in college with my jeans embroidered with peace signs, and they dangled the bait of changing history. I was recruited in late 1978, along with Mary Alice, Helen, and Natalie, as part of Project Sphinx, the first all-female squad. I put down my protest signs and stamped out my burning bra and let them make a killer out of me. Helen doesn't like that word, but I always ask her, why bother with anything else? It's simple and true. We kill for a living, a good living in case you're interested, with a solid base salary, bonuses, and benefits, including full dental and a pension. And we kill who we're told, and only who we're told. Let's get that clear right up front. We're not sociopaths. We don't murder for fun or for free. We kill to get paid. Now, Mary Alice loves her idealism and still clings to the notion of us murdering people who need killing in order to improve society. That was the official line when we were recruited. And even though times have changed, more computers and pencil pushers doing cost-benefit analyses, that part is not negotiable. We only kill people who are specifically targeted by the museum for extermination. And we don't freelance, ever. We don't murder on our days off any more than a thoracic surgeon will cut your rib cage open for kicks. We have standards.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.
Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Okay. Were you hearing me swearing at my computer?
I was not. I heard dead silence and I was like, good. Oh, it's going to be one of those podcasts.